Hello and welcome. I'm Stephen Brook, and this is a special edition of Media Talk. Coming up,
this is a very clear agenda for change in a sector that is changing very fast.
A blueprint for the future or a 21st century fudge? We'll look at landline levies, top slicing and analogue radio switch off as we analyse Lord Carter's Digital Britain report. Also in the podcast, censorship in Iran. Suzanne Breen spared jail for protecting her IRA sources. And finally this.
That's not Anne Robinson, is it? Jesus Christ. She's even got new tits.
Peter Sissons fires a parting shot at pretty-faced newsreaders as he announces his retirement from broadcasting. All this and much, much more. This is Media Talk from The Guardian. Well, we've rolled out the big guns for this week's show, and it's not just because I'm in my short-sleeve T-shirt. Emily Bell is The Guardian's Director of Digital Content. Now, Emily, you've been sleeping with the enemy this week. I hope you've still got something interesting to say for this program.
That's a slur on my character and a misrepresentation of my relationship with Steve Hewlett.
And Radio 4, because The Guardian's not in competition with the BBC.
No, we're not in competition. Can I just say that the media show team at Radio 4 said how much they love Media Talk because we can do all sorts of fucking things that they can't.
That's good to hear. Maggie Brown is a Media Guardian columnist. Hello, Maggie.
Hello.
Now, there's a rumour doing the rounds about you, which I know about because I started it last week on the pod. Apparently, you're taking over from Margaret on next year's Apprentice.
Well, I once was a business journalist, but I just don't think I've got the grey hair.
Right. Well, in fact, there's another job coming up, apparently. You could replace Arlene Phillips as a judge on Strictly Come Dancing.
Oh, now you're talking.
All right. And if the combination of Maggie and Emily wasn't exciting enough, we've also got James Robinson, the Observer's media editor here, and producer Ben has had a word in my ear, James. Apparently, it's traditional for you to be mightily hungover when you appear on the pod.
That is correct, yeah, unfortunately. I'm not hungover
today.
I'm fine, absolutely fine, actually. I'm extremely happy.
Okay, gang, enough of the pleasantries. It's time to talk policy. Yes, the long-awaited Digital Britain report was finally published this week. After months of teasing, Lord Stephen Carter finally delivered his 240-page document. Among the most eye-catching of the Communication Minister's 77 proposals are a £6 levy on all landlines to fund the rollout of the next-generation broadband, top-slicing the BBC licence fee, taking it away from the BBC, giving it to other companies to help fund, among other things, ITV regional news, and a switch-off date for analogue radio signal. The reaction to Lord Carter's magnum opus was not entirely positive. While Gordon Brown said that broadband is now as essential as water, electricity and gas, the Tories described the report as digital dithering, with the Shadow Culture Secretary Jeremy Hunt speaking for many when he said it was a, quote, colossal disappointment. Emily, let's start with you. If you want to imagine you're Peter Bradshaw for a second and Digital Britain was a film, how many stars would you be giving it?
I think I'll probably give it 3. Which is slightly more, perhaps, than I would have given it immediately, because whilst Jeremy Hunt's colossal disappointment, I think, flags up the fact there are no real sort of fireworks in there. There are one or two things which aren't exciting, but I think will be significant in the long term. It has underlying it a theme of taking actually sort of money out of an old system to fund a new system. So, for instance, the levy on copper landlines to fund not a 2 Mbps universal service obligation for broadband, but rather high-speed broadband by 2015-2016. Well, that's new. It's quite interesting. I mean, I think that, you know, the really controversial thing in the report, which I'm not a fan of top slicing, but is really opening the door to top slicing the BBC's licence fee. That, I think that in some ways that is the single thing that the report will be remembered for when everything...
Because, you know, we'll get onto that in a second. Let's talk about this levy first. I mean, James, who is this levy and this report really designed to help, and is it going to?
Well, I suppose the areas of the UK that can't be otherwise be reached, which really means that large areas of the countryside where it's not economically viable to build broadband networks, simple as that. I mean,
but even broadband, what now about 60% of the population have it?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, we can get carried away saying, oh, there's going to be high-speed broadband everywhere. We mustn't forget that there's already, actually, for two-thirds of the market, probably it would provide those speeds anyway, just because of, you know, I don't know what everyone's going to do with 40 or 50 Mbps, but if they want to watch hundreds of films simultaneously, they'll be able to. But it's the last third. It's the last third, which is always going to be problematic, because it's just not economic for phone companies to do. And I've just spent sort of a couple of weeks with my mum.
She's
in the wildest rural Lincolnshire, where she's on the end of a 0.5, you know, megabytes per second connection.
Torture
where,
for you, Emily.
It was completely. It was a lesson actually for me to say that it is actually quite important to get higher speeds out there, and it's simply not possible, even if you had the money to buy a higher speed connection, because the local exchange doesn't support it. And those are the things where, why would BT do that for a community of, you know, 20,000 or 30,000?
So, Maggie, is this a good use of tax or even of the BBC licence fee?
What really interested me about this report, and I don't think we've really focused on it, is that it's almost like a sort of throwback to the 1970s, when we had National Economic Development Councils, and you had these huge sectoral plans that maybe came to fruition, maybe didn't. I mean, steel industry, cars, that kind of thing. And in an interesting way, Stephen Carter's almost reactivating this form of almost, he calls it industrial activism. Now, I haven't seen anything like this on such an ambitious scale for an awfully long time. And I think that when a lot of the sort of, you know, that we've all sat down and thought about it, some of these things are really sensible. The idea that the whole of the country should one way or another be connected to as high a speed of broadband as is possible is absolutely, it seems to me, a no-brainer. Whether this £6, I'm sure it will be more, actually, levy is a good idea. This has to be debated by the politicians properly, and the economics of it really have to be costed, because I don't understand how it can meet some of the ambitions.
Does anyone else feel slightly apprehensive about the tax? I know it's only a £6 a year tax. It's a regressive tax.
I'm apprehensive,
and you say it could be more.
It's hitting people who have got copper landlines.
Yeah, so it's digital laggards. Digital laggards will have to pay for digital upgrade. Is that fair? I don't think that's fair.
Part of the report, too, it focuses correctly on the third or so who, for various reasons, are refused NICs. But one of the things that links all of them is that they tend to be poor.
Exactly.
You know, older,
exactly.
Poorer, exactly. Female. So the message that's coming out of this report, alas, okay, it's only the price of a bottle of wine or something, is that your broadband connection could actually be quite expensive. It's going to cost you. And I think that that is a really unfortunate side of this.
Well, final thought on the landline levy from Janine Gibson, who tweeted, "The only person who ever rings me on my landline is my mum. I'm not sure she's worth a 50p monthly levy."
It's, you know, we're learning something interesting about platforms and distribution here.
This is something she put on Twitter.
I saw it.
Then it's in the public domain, isn't it?
Yeah,
it is in the public domain.
Okay, moving on to top slicing. The BBC appears a big loser of the report. Sir Michael Lyons, chairman of the BBC Trust, is far from happy. He's been heard to say, "Don't treat the licence fee as a slush fund." Emily Bell, is he right?
Well, I, as I say, I'm not a fan of top slicing. I think that you need to keep these relations fairly clear and clean. The idea that people will pay their licence fee in order for some of it to be taken and not given to other services, because obviously, you know, through things like, you know, the WOC or the quota for independent production, the BBC's always distributed money to other services, but this is actually given to competing services.
Yeah.
And I feel, whilst acknowledging that the money has to come from somewhere and it shouldn't come out of the public sector, particularly not at the moment, I still don't see why you wouldn't just reduce the licence fee to the BBC and then have a separate funding mechanism for propping up, if you needed to, competitive services in the market. I'm still worried that actually this kind of idea that you need competitive services to the BBC, specifically to the BBC, is a little bit outmoded. However, me and the BBC have lost the argument on plurality. That's a big message from this. That actually, you know, that argument's gone. And so I sympathise with Michael Lyons, but I think it's going to happen. I mean, this is the point at which the licence fee ceases to be what it was.
Well, James Robinson, the licence fee, they want to set some of it aside to fund regional news, which is needed. Good idea or not?
Well, I mean, I agree with Emily that the principle of topsiding is a bad idea, simply because of the historic precedent that it sets. I can't help feeling that, yeah, the game has moved on, hasn't it? There's different types of regional news that will develop over the next 5 years, delivered in different ways. I'm not sure that fixing that old analogue model is necessarily the right way to proceed. You know, the bulletins. I mean, it's bad enough. If you're a BBC licensed fan, you end up paying for Anglia regional news on ITV produced by someone else. I mean, I'm not sure that's going to wash.
I don't think it was very clear in the statement that actually that's not the intention for the money. The intention is that the bulletins on ITV will be the sort of delivery mechanism for some of it, but it is meant to fund genuinely news services. But I think that message is quite confused. I think it's, you know, that people sort of lose sight of what they're trying to do, which means it's not properly expressed, I think.
Well, that's the danger, isn't it?
Jeremy Hunt had a very interesting point in his response, which was that Birmingham, Alabama has got 6 local TV news stations. Birmingham here, well, it's got ITV, that's it.
Yeah, I mean, although Manchester's got, of course, Channel M, and there's some, which is in part a news service, isn't it, I think. But
they're popping up.
It's not a great parallel because the geographical differences are so huge. I mean, America is not comparable in that sense of the UK. You know, it's a country of 350-odd million people.
I actually am more optimistic on top slicing because, look, let's face it, we've got a very weak government. They've had to, only in the past day or two, concede that the Iraq war inquiry should be in public, not in private. We've got backing down over Royal Mail privatisation. This is a very serious point for the BBC, and that if you were a trustee or you're Sir Michael Lyons, you have no option but to oppose it. And the reason is that we've already seen with this reserved fund for digital switchover, supposedly to pay for people converting, the government's already dipping into it and saying, oh no, we'll have some now for internet connections and we'll have some to fund 3 of these pilots. So already the principle has slipped. Now, we're told by the next licence fee extension, this 3.5% will be used for completely other purposes. Well, actually, should it?
Related to this, Maggie, is the whole Channel 4 BBC Worldwide amorphous mass, which the, you know, what did the report really say about it? It sort of said, a bit hard to work out at the moment. Come back to us when you've got something. We kind of like the idea. I mean, it fudged it, didn't it?
Well, it's saying that it wants to have a changed constitution for Channel 4, a remit rather, and that is really based on the Next on 4 document, which came out last year, which sees it more of an internet player than it has been, delivering more services for younger people via the web.
But what about the merger or the alliance between Channel 4 and BBC Worldwide?
Well, it's saying do it if you can, and we will facilitate it a bit.
But if you can't, don't worry.
Well, I was at Channel 4 yesterday evening, and my findings, my soundings would suggest the following: that Andy Duncan, the chief executive, thinks this is a very positive document because there's no privatisation proposed in it. Well, there would not have been privatisation had he not been banging on for 4 years that he needed government assistance.
Yes.
But, you know, he's rather Teflon coated on this point. They clearly think that there is some possible deal with BBC Worldwide. But let's just face it, you know, a lot of things have to happen which are all complicated and they involve a lot of commercial partners. The other option is that it cuts its cloth according to its, you know, more reduced ambitions and stops paying itself or its executives such huge amounts of money. What do you know what I really think has been...
Tell us, Maggie.
What really upsets me about this is that for 4 years, they've been banging on about how they need help here, there and the other way. What actually should have happened is that Channel 4 should have been campaigning over the rights issues so that the programmes it commissions and it largely pays for,
it got
has
the rights
more
to
of a back end.
And
yes.
got, them, got it the then, rights to make money out of them. Yes,
yes. And it then is a mini Worldwide in that it does own things itself. The pass was given away in 2003. For various reasons, Andy Duncan decided not to pursue that strategy, but I think it's wrong. And all of that energy that could have gone into something with a positive long-term effect for Channel 4 has not happened. That's why probably they do need fresh people at the top to take another look at things.
Okay, we've got to move on. Digital radio. Analogue switch off by 2015 and in-car DAB. Now, Matt Wells, who normally is the host here, He regards DAB as an interim technology, Emily Bell. Do you think the report is pushing in that direction or not?
Yeah, I mean, actually, when you say switching off analog, it's not really what it's doing. What it's saying is that the national stations must migrate to DAB, and that
so there'll still be a lot on analog.
Yeah, and FM will be reallocated, particularly to, you know, local licenses, community, etc. But we all know, you podcast listeners know better than everybody else, that actually the methods of distributing audio via the web are probably sort of where we're ending up. And the idea of DAB as an interim technology is probably right. The trouble is we don't know how long the interim is. And what this does is it throws a little bit of a lifeline to some of the sort of struggling commercial radio stations who have complained long and hard, and possibly justifiably, about the fact they just can't afford to carry both FM licence and DAB licence obligations, that they need it to be one or the other. And whereas in television, we were all sort of given the courtesy of being told, well, you know, as of 2012,
it's gone.
It's gone. In radio, there's been this sort of slight sort of flipping and flopping. So, yes, I think that it's
so this, this is a sort of sop to the industry.
Well, you know, you probably are more or less there, Stephen, aren't you? A man like you, I can't imagine that you're still listening to a steam valve radio in your. I mean,
why bother? You know, there's nothing new on. You can't get. There's very few things you can. Sorry, Stephen. There's very few things you can get on digital radio that you can't get on analog radio. So I bought a £10 analog radio from Tesco last week. Because I couldn't see the point in spending £50 on a digital.
But actually, you know, one of the good things about this is that, again, it's saying there has to be a properly built DAB network throughout the country. That's the bottom line. And that's been one of the big problems if you drive around.
Yeah.
So that is a big plus. Also, let's face it, that they can actually force manufacturers, in car manufacturers, to start putting DAB radios in as a standard.
It takes 6 years to get a new radio standard in a dashboard.
Right.
That's my industry factor, my motoring industry factor of the week.
You should have saved that until the end when we...
Oh, I've got a better one.
The thing I want to know about this report is, can it survive a Tory government? Because we're getting one at some stage or another.
Well, that's
Carter's off.
Yeah, that's got to be the big question, which is how much of this actually gets enacted. I mean, I suspect that they will find that the levy and the broadband plan for broadband, you know, I can't imagine that they will think of anything better than themselves. I think with the BBC, they may actually go for dropping the top slicing and just reducing full stop and returning it to taxpayers. I think with Channel 4, they will privatise it in a heartbeat if they get the opportunity. Mind you, that's what Labour said actually in 1996-7 privately. They were quite sort of
much easier for the Tories to do it though than Labour.
Well, it sort of is and isn't. I think it's one of those things where it's easy to say. It's always easy to make media policy in opposition, and it's very, very hard to put it into practice in government. They sort of become slightly captured.
Isn't the problem for the BBC on this point, Maggie, that the licence fee is now just an embarrassment of riches because it is so large? So much more than the commercial rivals or indeed anyone else has. And the BBC is so much larger and much more commercially aggressive and bigger that to as if the Tories, you know, reduce the licence fee, the BBC might complain, but will the taxpayers?
Well, I look at it another way, actually, which is that what the report hasn't done is look at ways to get more money into British content. That's the real question. It's not beggaring the BBC. It's actually what more money can be attracted in to make good standard programmes and content all over the place.
Isn't the point, though, that the licence fee is too large?
Well,
and the Tories have said we want to reduce it, and people will go, yeah, that's a good idea.
Well, I mean, if they want to hand back the digital switchover money, that's fine. Can I make a factual point, though, about Channel 4?
We're only interested in opinions on this programme,
we're missing a really important point, and I was discussing this very point last night. You have to remember that Channel 4 is created by a Conservative government, and it is in the Conservative DNA that they created an operation. It may not be perfect, but there are people who are very proud of this. And I was talking about this to some of the lobbyists at Channel 4, and they think that actually the Tories, rightly or wrongly, will allow them to continue in the role they are. I don't know if that's true or not.
I suspect that there are two media organisations broadly in the UK which the Tories are much closer to, certainly at the moment, than any others, and one is Sky and one is Google. And I'm not sure that I think that part of sort of Cameron's modernising would be actually saying Channel 4 is an almost irrelevance in today's media landscape. But as I say, it's very different when you actually get into government. I wouldn't put money on Channel 4 being allowed to continue as it is if there's a new administration.
Time will tell on that one. Okay, look, I think we've well and truly exhausted Digital Britain for now. You can read plenty more comment and analysis on mediaguardian.co.uk. Right, let's whiz around some of the other stories emanating from Medialand over the past 7 days. It's been a week, of course, that several journalists have featured in the Queen's Birthday Honours, Nicholas Coleridge and Bruff Scott, for two. Over to you, Baroness Bell of Finsbury Park. Let's talk about Nightjack.
Well, I just think it's an extraordinary thing, which is the
Tell
Times.
Tell us what's happened.
Well, the Times, through, and I'm now going to forget his name, which is going to be very ignominious for me, their media reporter, is it?
Patrick Foster.
It's Patrick Foster. I always want to call him Toby Foster. Patrick Foster set out to discover his identity, which he duly did, but the officer in question got an injunction to prevent it being published, saying that it would be very difficult for him to continue to write about being a senior police officer if everybody knew who he was. Justice Eady, our old friend Justice Eady, who knows all about privacy, etc., ruled this week that to overturn the injunction, and this because the Times was fighting it, saying that blogging is a public activity. So at which point Nightjack is revealed as Mr. Harnden, I think, from the Lancashire Constabulary.
And the blog is off now the airwaves.
And he said, I can't. Having won the Orwell Prize, it's now off air.
Has he been disciplined?
Yes, he's been disciplined by the force. He said that this was conduct unbecoming, etc.
Okay.
I think that the thing that I'm really struggling with is why the Times pursued the overturning of the injunction, because here we have this idea that, in a way, the direct-to-public publishing nature of blogs still doesn't sort of mask the fact that what Nightjack did was it talked about sort of areas of kind of public, genuine public interest in an uninhibited way, because there was a cloak of anonymity. And this is what newspapers often rely on for sources, etc. And so to have a media organisation saying, in a world where citizen, if you're a citizen journalist, effectively what ED is saying is that if you blog or put your stuff out there, you have no right to protect your own identity as a source. So maybe it's very clever. Maybe you have to go to the Times now to have your identity protected. I think it's sort of disgraceful the way that the Times pursued it.
Well, this segues quite nicely into another big journalism story of the week, which has happened in Northern Ireland, where journalist Suzanne Breen has won the right to withhold information from police about the real IRA sources that she has used in her journalism. They took her to court to demand information over a story she'd written about the murders of two British soldiers. But a judge today acknowledged that there was great public interest in catching the killers of these men, but that the journalist's right to life outweighed that, and she had said if she had to reveal information about her sources, she would die.
Common sense prevails.
So, I mean, this could be an important test case, could it not, Maggie?
Well, of course it could. And all I can say is thank goodness. I mean, why should any more journalists have to die, especially in the embers of a conflict such as Northern Ireland?
Well, in happy news, Radio Times has got a new editor, independent executive editor Ben Preston, and he was deputy editor of the Times, but he actually edited it for about a year when Peter Stoddard got ill.
It's a very
ill.
Interesting appointment, really,
isn't
because
it?
It's gone from, being Jill Hudson, who's come from the sort of magazine world. Before that, she was at Maxim and Good Housekeeping, and some have criticised her for her, undoubted populist tendencies. I think she's managed a very difficult brief very well, I have to say. But now we're going to what you could sort of call a very solid newspaper man who'll run a weekly very well too. So it's interesting.
Yeah, but he's also got, had a very populist sort of a light touch. And, he was the guy at the Times who pushed the sort of show-busy stories and the more, what you would call the lightweight stories, I suppose, if you're being unkind.
Well, it sells a million copies still every week.
It is the third highest circulating news magazine in the country. country still when every newspaper's got a free supplement every week on it. So interesting to see what he does there.
Maybe rename it Digital Radio Times.
That's right, DAB Times.
Yeah, DAB Times.
I thought that was a really interesting comment, though, that people would like to see the listener revived. And I must admit, there was a side of me that thought,
oh,
yes.
Oh, Maggie, only would you would they? Be thinking. We're moving on.
Could we have a poll, please?
I'm not sure if she got an invite to Rebecca Wade's wedding, but she certainly would have got an invite to Rupert Murdoch's big shindig this week. Patience Wheatcroft is coming out of retirement to re-enter the News Corp mothership. She's going to head up the Wall Street Journal, Europe's new London-based operation. James, is this a good appointment?
Yeah, I think so. She did a very good job at the Sunday Telegraph, I thought, after Sarah Sands departed.
I don't think Murdoch McLennan agreed with you.
Well, no, because I think it was more of a, getting onto dangerous territory here, but more of an argument about structure and how an integration with the Daily and having our own resources. Sort of touchy subject for an Observer journalist who hasn't actually written for the Observer for the best part of a month.
We better swiftly. Emily. I mean, Rupert Murdoch loves her. Les Hinton loves her. Robert Thompson loves her. She's back.
She's a class act. Mm. I mean, I think that undoubtedly she's where she should be, which is running a serious, you know, financial paper.
Rather than sitting on the board of Barclays.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think that you have to kind of raise questions about how much commitment there is to expanding Wall Street Journal Europe in the current climate.
But anything to strike at the FT, they would, wouldn't they?
Well, it's sort of where it's where Murdoch has his A team now, and the people he feels most comfortable and closest to, which are certainly Les Hinton and Robert Thompson, and certainly Patience Wheatcroft, who actually his relationship with her, you know, sort of stretches back really before Thompson edited the Times.
Well, she's a workaholic, isn't she? As well, she is very, very industrious. That I do know. And the other thing about her is that, actually, clearly, moving back to London, I never understood why the Wall Street Journal was in Brussels anyway. It always seemed to me bonkers because they thought it was political power which mattered, when actually this is the financial centre.
I was going to say, it's also that thing where Americans look at a map and they go, oh, Brussels, that's very close to London. There's a train. Okay, we'll put
we'll
it there.
Do it.
It's a little bit like Yahoo moving all their London staff to Geneva, and they couldn't really understand why people were at all upset.
Yeah. Okay, if you want to have your say on any of these topics or all of them, post your comments on the blog at guardian.co.uk/mediatalk. Well, the news has been dominated this week by the violent unrest in Iran following last week's presidential election. More than 30 people have been killed and thousands injured as government forces continue to clash with supporters of Mir Hossein Mousavi, who insist that he beat Mahmoud Ahmadinejad at the ballot box. The government's worked hard to disrupt the flow of information about the protests. It's banned journalists from covering the demonstrations, it's threatened bloggers, and it's tried to block websites like Facebook that have been a vital tool in the opposition movement. Now, Emily, Twitter's got all the headlines in relation to this, but there's a much bigger issue of censorship here, isn't there, for foreign journalists?
Yes. I mean, you know, anyone who heard Lindsay Hilson from Channel 4 sort of basically saying, well, I'm sitting in my hotel room and I'm not going anywhere soon, will know that, you know, it's...
But I'm still here because...
She's saying I'm still here,
To be kicked out of the country will do no one any favours.
No, exactly. And that it's very hard to get back in. And, of course, we recently had the American journalist who was arrested in Iran on spying charges and... You know, it's a very, very difficult place to do business. Iran is an incredibly tech-savvy country, you know, much more so probably than people realise. It's got a number
Because they've got a massive young population, don't they?
Yeah, and they've also got, you know, they do have some of the infrastructure and the knowledge, and, you know, they have been imprisoning bloggers in the past, but it hasn't stopped this proliferation of knowledge about how to use proxy servers and social sites. And I noticed at the top of the 10 o'clock news last night had a number of pictures which I recognised as coming from social media feeds as well as its own pictures for
front
the first
of the
time.
Evening Stand as well. Here are photos that we've been sent via Twitter.
You know, this is a really extraordinary thing. I mean, if you think about sort of heavily censored, areas of the world, maybe as recently as 5 years ago, if you'd had that sort of report, you'd have had a rather crackly landline and a picture of a map and a static picture of the correspondent. And now you've got this real sort of beating heart of information which is coming out of a whole sort of series. As I say, Twitter has been a great tool in terms of making all of this information findable, and findable for the people who are protesting as well as for news organisations like ourselves and the BBC.
So, James, how much is Twitter changing the landscape of citizen journalism and helping professional reporters out in situations
I mean, clearly it is. The photos you get, the images you get, and the contents you get, I mean, as long as you treat them, it's an obvious point, but as long as you treat them with caution, because obviously they're very difficult to verify.
Well, they are.
Especially when they're anonymous. But
particularly in the case of Iran, because people have been deliberately faking tweets, etc., to try and put the Iranian government off. So if you're a journalist and you're trying to farm this information, you can easily run into
traps.
That's
right. We've all had to change our status to Tehran, which helps to confuse. If you say that you're in Tehran, when you're in London, it sort of helps to confuse the authorities, apparently. But, you know, James's point about authentication is sort of right in a way, because, I mean, one of the points that's been made is that, yes, there's an enormous amount of anger and it's kind of snowballing. I think some people thought that it would possibly fizzle out, but it's gained momentum. There are still a lot of people in Iran who voted for Ahmadinejad. They just don't tend to be the people who are, you know, young women who are actually sort of part of the kind of radicalised generation. But then again, you know, you had the Iranian football team in South Korea
wearing
green armbands.
Up until half-time, at least.
And you see that again.
But the message got out, didn't it?
But the message got out, and the viral nature of it, and the fact that you can appear in an Iranian football team in South Korea with a green armband on and the world can know what it means is really something extraordinary.
Yeah. It doesn't make you wonder what will happen, you know, the next time there's a Tiananmen Square. And there's Twitter. It does make you want to have the dynamics of that.
I think it is a really interesting thing, because most news organisations, we like to think that we live where the event is, but for nearly all of us, nearly all of the time, that's not the case. You know, we have to have time to get to where the event is. It's difficult to get people in, etc., etc. And now we are seeing that actually, you know, the people who live where the event is are genuinely the source of it, and it's not. You know,
and they can bring us closer to the story.
They are the story, and you know, you can. They're not really. And citizen journalism, they're just citizens or witnesses, actually. And the way, you know, our role in all of this is really to help sift, contextualize, assess, you know, weigh and redirect people around this information. You know, that's a kind of, it's a very interesting landscape for news organizations to navigate.
An eyewitness to history. Okay, we'll leave that story there. You can follow this story as it continues to develop at guardian.co.uk/Iran. Now, there's no Gareth McLean anymore. He has left the building. But Maggie, how would you like to take the lead in our not-as-rude-as-usual TV section? What have you been watching this week? Occupation, by any chance?
Oh, yes, I've been watching Occupation. I think it's really very interesting. It's one of the new genre of BBC dramas that are meant to be more cutting-edge, contemporary. Fantastic performance by James Nesbitt. And also trying to, I think, introduce, how can we put it, almost like a personal tragedy into the whole thing. I won't tell you what happens
tonight. Because he's the kind of soldier
tonight.
That goes back
he's
to Iraq.
He's a family man. You see him in Iraq being, whether in Basra, this is the real point, they're British soldiers. He rescues a child who's going to die by ensuring that she's flown back to England. And in the process, falls in love with a doctor. So we have a war drama, but we also have a great sort of personal human tragedy, which, against all my better nature, burst into tears. It's so sad.
Well, this is interesting, isn't it? Because it's a big flagship drama. Yeah. It's almost a mini-series format, James, because it's three episodes and it's all on 1 week. Have you been watching?
I have been watching. Yeah, I have been watching. I like the guns more than the personal tragedy. Sorry.
It's all right. I tuned in expecting it to be the sequel to The Apprentice. I thought Occupation.
I'll just move on. Finally, this week, Peter Sissons. He's announced his retirement from TV news after 45 years of graft, but he's had a go at pretty presenters like Natasha Kaplinsky.
How dare he?
Yes, telling the Sunday Mirror that Natasha's done very well out of her looks. I suppose any bright woman with good looks who can make herself £1 million a year must be doing something right from her point of view, but that he's never watched Five News from beginning to end.
So, 29 seconds.
It lasts. Would anyone like to say something nice about Peter Sissons?
I love it. Peter Sissons is brilliant. I mean, he looks... He's just constantly grumpy, isn't he? He's the only on air. He reads the news. He just looks like completely pissed off. I love it. I love that. I would say, though, that I think it's such an easy target. Presenters generally, I think, have become a very easy target. And it's not the case that every reporter makes a good presenter, or indeed that presenting is an easy job necessarily. I think it's a bit unkind.
I just refer people to my favourite film of all time, which is Broadcast News.
Yes.
And the bit where the very clever reporter sweats so much on air that he fuses the mics.
Yes. Yeah. Well, that's pretty much it for our special edition of the pod. Before I let you go, I want to know one thing that you have each learned from the media world this week. So I'll kick you off. I actually learned that Trinity Mirror boss Sly Bailey's favourite TV show and box set is Tales of the City. Emily Bell, what did you learn this week?
I learned this week that my secret marriage to Stephen Carter was doomed from the outset.
Maggie Brown.
Well, just as well, because I learned this week that, this was the talk at the party I went to last night anyway, that Stephen Carter's going to Australia, not just for a holiday.
Oh, I learned that too.
Yeah, I learned that as well. Yeah. But I also learned, sorry to continue the theme, but I learned that Stephen Carter has fallen out of love with tank tops. Because he was very fond of them. Every press conference I went to, he wore a tank top. Now he's morphing into sort of Peter Mandelson-esque smooth.
Yes, that's true. He used to be very sort of preppy, didn't he, in his style? That's
excellent. Thank you very much, James, Maggie and Emily. Media Talk's produced by Ben Green. I'm Stephen Brook. Thank you for listening.